Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 114, being recorded on the 10th of February, 2016, with special guest Sam Gabor. My name is Sujit Mello, and on Skype, of course, I have Kale Teeter and our special guest Sam. And I guess Evan is out. He's on a offsite, I think, right? Is that what he said, Kale?
I think he said he was away for work, yeah.
Yep. So it's the three of us today, and we'll give Sam a very special guest, very especially for me, and I've known Sam for many years, and we'll get to that in a minute so that we can introduce him and also let him share some of his experiences with Azure. But before we get there, I think we did that last episode from Seattle, and it was at the Tech Ready conference, the Microsoft internal conference. You got to say, the focus is just amazingly on the cloud now from the Microsoft perspective. It's just amazing. Everything is cloud, cloud, cloud. There's so much focus on Linux, which is also amazing. I posted it on our Azure Podcast Twitter feed. I'm not sure if you get that or you subscribe to that, Kale. But they gave me a little penguin, you know, the Linux penguin, and it says Microsoft.com/opencloud. Who would have thought that, you know, the Linux penguin would be co-branded by Microsoft at some point? If you had asked me a few years ago, I would have thought you were crazy. Such is the case, and it's good. It's all good, actually. Just to focus on open technologies, open cloud, trying to embrace all possible platforms. As long as you run your stuff in Azure, don't really matter what language you use or what platform you use. So it's very, very comforting to see all that. So you had some things about the band on the...
Yeah, I stumbled upon this week. I thought it was interesting because we talked about the band before and about how data was being sent to the cloud and, you know, some crunching was happening on that data and things. But there's actually a new app that's out there now called Export Band. And I just thought it was funny because basically this will allow you to kind of export some of that data out. It's in this GPX format, which basically is the GPS tracked activities. So I just thought it was interesting to come across that there's an app now that they're starting to actually be able to, you know, kind of pull some of this data out so you can start to manipulate it yourself. Thought it might be interesting.
That's good. And by the way, I know I happen to know that Sam also has a Microsoft band, so I'm sure he'll relate to some of that discussion as well.
Yep.
That's a nice find. I know that's been a pain point, right, until now, to be able to export the data out of the Microsoft Health System.
Yep.
So this gives you that option. The other thing that I found is, I'm not sure if this was widely known before, but I guess this is if you have an Azure account, in the portal, and you want to transfer that account to somebody else. I'm not sure if it was, I think you probably had to open like a support ticket and go through those steps before. But now there is a self-service way of doing it. So if you have an account, maybe on behalf of a company, and now you're transitioning roles or leaving the company and you need to transfer that account to somebody else, there is a self-service way to do that now, you know, so you can kind of officially transfer the entire account and all the resources within that account to somebody else within the company or whatever may be the case. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, besides the band thing. And then you had some other things in there as well, Kale, I noticed.
Yeah, I had a couple around storage because it's kind of close to me. The two big ones that stand out is we have, we talked about Azure Search before based on some Lucene technology, but there are Azure Search that's in the cloud. That, basically in the past, you could basically set up indexers for it to kind of crawl SQL databases or document DBs. But now it's actually expanded to blob storage, which is interesting. Because that's kind of hard to do. Flat storage, when we're just storing flat files out there. If you've done this in the past, anybody, and I'm sure Sam's probably been down this path, many programmers have, where you're thrown either a fixed format or unstructured kind of file, and you need to kind of crawl that file and do things. So this has some built-in support, but there is some limitations. It only understands certain formats of data that would be put out there, like PDF and some of the Office documents, HTML, and plain text files. But it's kind of interesting that we're able to kind of enable that feature, though, so that you can just take Azure Search and point it at some blob storage with potentially some documents from the Office and have those things be indexed. I thought that was a really cool feature.
That's amazing. I mean, I wonder how it peeks into the blob to figure out what's in there.
Yeah, there's like you can read the blog post. This is in preview, by the way, but it's there's basically you define a little kind of schema thing for it. So it's like in JSON when you make the call, and basically tell it like, here's how I'm going to connect, here's my storage account creds, that kind of thing. And then you also tell it kind of what you want to index, what the fields are, and that kind of thing. So interesting. The other one with storage is around premium. So there's a lot of people probably, especially if you're running IaaS VMs, premium storage is a big thing because of performance. And it's been limited to certain regions, but that's expanded now. So I think it was, is that yesterday? Yeah, yesterday we announced that it's going to be available in East Asia, Australia, Southeast, and South Central US. So just an expanded footprint there for the Azure Premium Storage.
Cool, very cool. And then I noticed you put something on the Azure Stack tools for PaaS and DevOps. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, there's a preview out there because we made that preview of the stack, and you had went through that in the previous podcast. And today there's some new stuff out there for helping you kind of get started with the PaaS and the DevOps stuff. So you should take a look at that. It's pretty nice docs, and I think there's even a video and stuff there where they kind of walk through that stuff with Mark Rusinovich.
And all this, a lot of the stuff is on GitHub, so listeners can try it out and provide feedback, or even make a what you take a clone of the thing and then make a pull request if necessary. I learned a lot about GitHub, I gotta say that last week, so it's become my new favorite tool.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. You mentioned that the pull request, because I just had one accepted for a pretty big repo out there, and you have that happen. It's kind of cool because it's affecting a lot of people, but it's also a little terrifying because whenever the build breaks, it'll be you.
Well, your code is now out for everybody to see, right? And everybody to critique. That's the other thing. You know how every developer in the world has their own opinion on how code should be written. So it's always interesting to see some of the results, some of the discussions on GitHub with the issues, when they have the issues discussion.
That's
Cool.
actually how mine worked. It's kind of natural how that stuff works. I've been using an open source library for something, and I was like, this thing doesn't work when I use, and Sam and we were talking before the podcast started about interoperability in the open source world, and when you start mixing these things together, a lot of times they're not compatible or something breaks, and I had run into that. So it's funny because everybody always, at least when I hear it, they say, oh, it's so easy. You can go out on GitHub and then you can make changes and everybody's happy. But for me, it was always like, it's like, okay, I found this problem. I figured out how to fix it. I submitted an issue. And then I'm like, here's how you fix it. And then it was like, so I did all the research and had everything there. And then the guy was like, okay, do a pull request and then we'll accept it, But so it was like this really staged thing, and I was like being very careful about it. But
Cool.
it's funny.
Congratulations. Is that your first pull request being accepted, or?
I've had other ones, but they were mostly internal. This was one that was a pretty widely used library, so it was kind of cool.
Is that, you want to tell us which library that is?
Yeah, that's fine. It's in the prompt library, so if you're using Node, I was actually using it for something, and there's another library called Streamline. So if you haven't heard of this, Streamline's really cool. So what it does is, we're getting off on a tangent here, but the Streamline will instead of you having, when you do JavaScript, you typically have to have do something and then you call a callback. And that can get to be like cumbersome if you're going two and three levels deep. You'll end up with this big tree if anybody's written complex JavaScript where you have all these callbacks and you kind of got to keep track of that and then you got to figure out how you're going to do exception handling and that kind of thing. Streamline kind of makes that easier. So you just put a little underscore there wherever a callback is. And it basically treats it kind of like the way we do our async stuff in C Sharp. So it makes it look like a synchronous function, even though it's asynchronous. And so it will return a value and that kind of thing, and then you can just wrap that. And the issue was the prompt library. So the prompt is really nice. It's a library in Node to allow you to do prompts. So you could like prompt a user for something, and then you can have conditional statements to say, should I prompt them for something else? The problem was there's a lot of callbacks in there, and when I mixed it with Streamline, it broke. And so there was just a small change to fix that issue.
Okay. Now, I guess, is this similar to Promises Streamline?
That's different.
Okay.
I don't. It's not as full-fledged as that. It's just really a way to wrap the async call so that you can get a return out of it right there, instead of having to have it go through another function, basically another
Okay.
callback. Yeah,
Okay.
it's really cool. We use it actually. If you look at our CLI tool, the XPath CLI tools, that uses Streamline heavily. Cool.
Okay, so then let's get to our guest today, Sam Gabor. So I'll just say a couple of things. I mean, Sam and I go way back. I've worked for him for at least a couple of companies before I joined Microsoft, and it's always been every experience has been great working for Sam. He's not only a great technical person, but phenomenal person to work with as well. And it was kind of a sad time when we had to go our different ways. But looks like he's done very well for himself. So I'll let Sam introduce himself and tell us where he's at now. Sam?
Okay, thank you very much, Sujit. And thank you, Kale. It's a very, sorry, very generous introduction of you. We've had a very nice long collaboration on many projects over the years, and it's very nice of you to ask me to come and be a guest on your podcast. So I'll just give you a quick overview of my background, and then I'll talk to you about SendGrid and Azure and how I came about to use SendGrid within this environment. And please, stop me if you have any questions or anything.
Sure.
So as you know, Sujit, about 20 years ago, I started this small software development consultancy. It's called Advanced Trading Solutions. And my company primarily focuses on custom automation solutions for back office processing for financial firms. So the type of stuff that like a Charles Schwab, for example, would have to do, or a TD Ameritrade. And those are typically very arcane tasks that have to do with settling trades, paying dividends, and so forth. So that's what my company focuses on. And when Azure was released, I looked at it and I said, wow, this is such an extremely rich environment. It offers so many features. I started looking at this probably about at least 2 or 3 years ago, and I really wanted to find a use case for it for some of the work that I do at ATS. Unfortunately, for big financial firms and service bureaus, as you know, because of the restrictive regulatory environment, there's a need always to maintain absolute control over the computing environment. So they have to control the data, they have to control the network, the servers. So it was very difficult for me to convince anyone that I deal with on a day-to-day basis to experiment with Azure. So I had to shift gears and come up with my own project that was outside the scope of work that I do on a professional level. But it was a fun project nonetheless. What I basically wanted to do was to design a
Sorry,
system.
Sam. I just want to
Sure.
just interject here for 1 minute. I just want to say something that You've always been with the Microsoft technologies, right? That's one thing that's been fairly common with the work that we've done. And you obviously
That's
focus a
correct.
lot on, I mean, it was all Visual C++ and all in the early days, and now moved on to .NET in a big way. So
Yes.
that's so you're coming in with that whole Microsoft kind of background, so to speak.
Yeah, and I was just discussing with Kale before you joined us that I kind of long for those old days when it was just a single stack to worry about, and everything was supplied by one vendor, and you didn't have any compatibility issues. So, but the marketplace wanted to go in a different direction, and we all have to cope with it now. So,
True.
when I looked at Azure, I wanted to use as much as possible from the services in the environment for a new system that I was thinking of. And then the system, I'll just give you a very quick overview of what it does. Think of it this way. If you have an appointment at a dentist's office, for example, and you have to cancel the appointment at the last minute, that dentist's office usually has to scramble to fill that appointment. Because if it's a slot that you're not going to take, it's a decreased revenue for that practice. So the system that I have is a system called Fill Appointment. It allows professional offices, a dentist or a doctor, anyone really providing an interchangeable professional service, to fill appointments that become available on very short notice. So this system consists of a number of components. All of them run in Azure at this point. There's a web service, there's an API, there's actually a client component that talks to the services in Azure. But the subject that we wanted to discuss here today is really the SendGrid component, which is the component that does the notification to the users that are likely candidates to fill an appointment. So that's what I'll focus on. But if you have other questions about the service itself, by all means, definitely bring them up.
Okay, so that's a good thing. So we'll focus on SendGrid, but now you also mentioned that you're doing a lot of this in within the your MSDN account, right? You have an MSDN subscription with Azure. Is that how you got started?
That's correct, yes. That's
Yeah.
correct. Everything is under the MSDN account, and I found it to be a very generous allocation, really, for experimenting with the Azure environment, and just seeing if a system that you have in mind is going to be viable in the marketplace. So it's been extremely valuable and useful to me when for launching this new system.
Okay, and now the SendGrid thing that I mean, I think that what I know about it, and I don't know, Caleb maybe knows a lot. I'm sure he always knows more than I do, so that goes without saying. But I think it sends email, right? That's the primary function of SendGrid, or.
Yes, SendGrid sends email. That's the primary function, but it's such there's so much to it, Sujit, that and I'll cover a couple of the things that they provide that make it a very valuable, very helpful service for businesses that need to do bulk mailing in this environment.
Okay, and Kale, do you remember? Is that a company we bought, SendGrid, or is that a partner that we work with? It's hosted in Azure.
It's a partner we work with, and it's kind of interesting. SendGrid, they're slightly different than some of the offerings in Marketplace. There's different types of offerings up there, but some of them are full VMs. But in this case, it's not. You're not. It's not in that model.
It's a
It's
PaaS
more of a
service, right?
SaaS.
Oh,
It's more of a
SaaS.
SaaS.
Okay.
So, where you would basically set up, and Sam can talk about it, but basically you set up an account with SendGrid, but it kind of integrates in through our Marketplace as well.
I see. So the
But
billing
yeah,
is all
I'll let.
done through the marketplace itself. Yep.
Yep.
Okay. So good. Sorry, Sam. Go ahead.
No problem at all. So the first thing that I just want to make sure that everybody knows about, there's a caveat about sending bulk email. The Federal Trade Commission has a regulation called canned spam, and it's very detailed, and it lists all the guidelines that you have to follow. under a very hefty penalty if you don't comply with them. So if you just Google GANs, can spam or Bing can spam, you'll be able to find the site. And
it's canned spam, like CANTSBAM, like that?
Actually, it's CAN dash spam.
Oh, yeah, canned spam.
Canned spam.
Okay, I thought canned spam. I thought they didn't want you to spam. Okay.
Yeah. So, the funny thing spam, is, but under these guidelines.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, before I joined Microsoft a long time ago, back in the early days in the internet, you know, spam used to be a bigger problem. It still is a problem, but back then I was working for a company and it was startup-ish, and you know, they were getting bigger and bigger, and the marketing team launched a campaign, they called it, and you end up getting blacklisted very quickly.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's not a cool thing when that happens, because telcos are involved, like the network providers are involved, saying, yeah, we confirmed they did that, and, you know, this kind of thing. So that's not cool.
Perfect segue into what I was going to just mention, Kale. So why did I choose SendGrid? I could have, you know, did it the same way that we used to do things in the old days, where fire up a VM, run the SMTP service, and you're basically all done. I would have had perfect control over the SMTP server. I didn't have to worry about the number of messages being sent out or going over any limits that SendGrid has. But although that approach would have worked initially just to get a quick SMTP server up and running, in the long term, it's just not viable anymore. I think sending email, bulk email, is a very involved business at this point, because of all the spam filters and all the different technologies that exist on the various ISPs to prevent spam from getting to their users. So it just was not going to work, and I could tell it's not going to work because of all the different obstacles that I experienced when I was looking at this initially. So I looked at what SendGrid was offering in this MSDN environment, and there's actually a free allocation of 25,000 messages per month that all MSDN subscribers get. So within that 25,000 messages per month, I've been able to run this service, and I've never had to go over it. I'm still only testing it on a limited basis at this point, but it's been extremely helpful at that level. If you find yourself that needing to go beyond that 25,000 message level, I think their first paid tier is 40,000 messages per month, and that's about $10. And it can go up to 700,000 messages at about $400 per month. And they have higher plans as well if you ever need to go beyond that.
It's ridiculously cheap. I mean, for the service that they're providing, they have a really nice – I've used it a little bit as well, Sam, and it's a – the API is really thought through, mature. I mean, it works really well.
Yeah,
and,
I was
going to
ask
for the price,
about the API. Like, how do you integrate your application with that, Sam?
So yeah, I'm gonna actually talk about that a little bit. But okay. I was gonna say that you can use, you know, SendGrid for a number of uses. Like in my case, it was targeted notifications, but you can also use them for marketing campaigns, newsletter distribution, customer notifications. All sorts of you know, use cases can definitely leverage what SendGrid offers. So in terms of the API, I'm using, of course, I'm a .NET guy, as you know, Sujit, so I had to make use of the .NET SMTP component. It was something that I've worked with extensively in my own professional practice, so I ended up using it in this environment. And it works in a very simple way. You provided a user ID, a password, and pointed to the smtp.sendgrid.net server. And that's it. You're able to send email that way. Now, the way that I send the email is through a web job that's running within the Azure environment, and that web job gets notified when there's a message to be sent out. So it picks it up and it connects to SendGrid and it sends it out that way. But as Kale mentioned, they actually have a number of APIs available. They do have a web API that you can use. They also have something called webhooks, which allow you to receive almost real-time notifications of the status of every email that you try to send out. So if I send them an email, they would, and it gets delivered, I get back a confirmation that this email was delivered through this webhook. Their documentation quality is excellent. If you look at their website, it's very detailed. They have very good examples. They have a classroom, various tutorials. It's really a phenomenal service.
And all that stuff is for the first 25,000 messages free, right? Including the webhooks and the other
services. It's available. Pretty much everything that they offer is available at the free level, with the exception of dedicated IP addresses. It helps on the delivery side if you have a dedicated IP address for your message senders. But in my usage, I found that there are a number of other remedies that you can pursue so that you don't really need the fixed IP address even at this level.
One other thing to point out here, and you kind of touched on it there, is this is a common question that comes up. People go, well, you know, Azure's got a million services up there already. I'm sure they have some way to send email. And this is one of the ways to send email. There's no native service that's built into our platform to enable this kind of feature. I mean, if you're using O365, there's ways to do it through there. But again, you're going to have to write some things to do that. But this is really something driven by the partners. And
Exactly, Kill. Yeah, I researched like what options I have in this Azure environment, and this one was the one that was the only viable one that was really available. So, and it's very easy to get up and running with it if you have an MSDN account. So I would recommend it to anybody that wants to use email in their application. It's very quick to get up and running.
Now, Sam, you mentioned that there are some things to watch out for bulk email. Like what are some things, what should people do to avoid getting into trouble with the authorities and whatnot?
I'll mention a couple of very important things, but let me just tell you about they have something called a dashboard within SendGrid that allows you to track all the messages that you send out. So it can give you a breakdown by the number of messages that you submitted, the number that were rejected for, let's say, bad email addresses or mailbox full rejections. If somebody flags one of your emails as spam, you would also see that. And they have other sophisticated features that allow you to even track whether your emails were opened or not, and whether someone clicked on links in your email. I don't make use of those additional features, but for someone who's doing a marketing campaign, those would be extremely valuable. So I just wanted to point those out. Their support is actually quite excellent. Any request that I opened was usually addressed, responded to, and closed within 24 hours. To answer your question, Sujit, in terms of helpful things for somebody who's going to be using the service, especially for ensuring that their emails get delivered, and this was a tip that they actually gave me, SendGrid gave me in one of the support requests that we sent. There's a website called mail-test.com. And if you go to that website, all it does is it's going to give you a unique email address. So what you do is you take this unique email address and you send an email to it through SendGrid. Or if you want to experiment, you can just use your own Outlook, email address. Send an email to that unique email address that they give you. And then you can go to a web page that shows you the score of that email that you just sent, whether or not it's going to make it through various spam engines. So it actually does a lot of very technical analysis of the headers and the senders and the domains and everything to tell you whether or not that message is a high likelihood of making it to the recipient.
I see. And does it also scan the content of the message or the subject matter, for example?
To be honest, I'm not sure about that. I was focused on the headers because that's right. I knew that I didn't have anything objectionable in the body of my email. So,
no, I mean, like, you know how people, I guess some systems will look for words like, you know, dollar sign, or you know how it is, all those buzzwords.
Casino.
Casino, yeah.
Yeah, it does actually.
Or whatever. But.
It does actually, yeah, I know. It does actually, though, point out some things that you don't think of. And that's when you send email, the body of the email can actually have a text, pure text, and also HTML. And if you're only sending HTML, it actually subtracts a little bit from your score, apparently, because mm-hmm. you're supposed to provide an alternate rendering of the email for some email readers. Mm. So it gets, I mean, there are all sorts of checks that site does, and you can go through each one of them and just go through where you're losing points on the email, and then you can improve the deliverability of the emails that you send out.
That's really cool. I think we should put a link to that, Sajid, in the show notes.
That's very, very useful, yeah.
Yeah.
The second thing is you have to use something called the domain white label. And just very basically what that does is it puts specific DNS entries in your DNS registrar so that they can determine that SendGrid is a permitted sender for your domain. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you get some funky stuff, like if you look at the email on Google, for example, it might say from XYZ on behalf of, you know, ABC. And all that's controlled by the white labeling on the domain. So they have a very good write-up on how you do that also within SendGrid. So that, again, that's one of the things that they pointed out to me, and we implemented it. And we have a very high reputation as far as the emails that we deliver. And this is one thing I forgot to mention. On the dashboard, they give you a reputation score based on how many emails you sent out and how many were returned. So I think we're very close to the 99% level. We're always striving to reach as, you know, as close as possible to 100%, because then you know that all your emails are getting through.
So return means because of bad email addresses and things like that?
Bad email addresses, or they could be rejected also
By some intermediaries.
By a spam filter or something. Yeah.
And I actually came across this with the OptOnline and Comcast. For a while, they just refused the any email coming from my system. And I traced that to two things, the domain white labels. That was one reason. The other reason is that third tip that I was going to give you, which is always be on top of any recipients that flag your email as spam. Because whenever you mark an email as spam, that gets reported somehow to Yahoo and OptOnline if you're using their mail readers, of course. So, and what they track this, and then they apparently build a database, and they reject your email before it even makes it to the recipient. So it's not, the recipient never sees your email. It gets blocked at the Comcast level or at the OptOnline level. So it's different than the old days when it used to go into, you know, the recipient's spam folder. That doesn't happen anymore. And if you wanted to, if the recipient wanted to actually provide an exception, they can't anymore in some cases. So it's that restrictive, yes. So those were the things that really helped us get past these various roadblocks for delivering email.
And how was performance in general with SendGrid? Sending email. I mean, I know you're not sending like millions of messages, but was that ever an issue?
It was never an issue, but for my usage, it's really not that important. It's not so time critical that that I have to be worried about all, you know, 100 messages have to be sent out in an hour. I think based on some informal metrics that I looked at, it's on the order of about 100 messages per minute.
I'm sure they must be throttling everybody, right, to some level, just to avoid, like, too much from.
Yeah, probably, yeah. I think if somebody is very worried about that, they would have to look very carefully at what the performance metrics are. Yeah, but it didn't apply to our usage at all.
Oh, that's really, really helpful tips over there. Thanks, Sam.
No, sure. So, I mean, in summary, I really can't say enough good things about Azure. And just to follow on one point that you guys mentioned at the beginning, I didn't want to interrupt, but in the past couple of months, I've spun up so many Linux VMs in Azure because I was doing some stuff with some big data analytics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very nice feature where before I install one more piece of open software that's going to break my system, I take a checkpoint of the whole VM. So if the VM stops working,
yeah,
I can roll it back. So I make heavy usage of all these nice features in Azure, and it's really a phenomenal working environment. And Microsoft did a great, great job with this service. So.
Thank you. Thanks, Sam. That's very, very
sure.
nice coming from you. I'll just add one more thing to that is, I spent a lot of time playing with containers and the Microsoft Container technology this past week, the past couple of weeks when mm-hmm. I was in Seattle. And that's another great the use case you just mentioned, which is, you know, taking a snapshot of a VM because you're worried about mucking it up. Containers is a good way to do that, right? You load up stuff in a container, get the image, and then make changes to it. If it doesn't work, blow it away. Or if it does work, you just make a new image out of it. The whole container technology, I think my eyes were opened up a little bit. I was a little skeptical about it before. But, I think we're quickly going from VMs to containers, I think. Cale, you've done some work with containers, right?
Yeah, no, it's a big thing. I've been working even just daily on that, actually on some of the Docker side of the house, working on those things. So, great technology. And to just comment a little bit more on the SendGrid thing, I mean, I've used this tech before. It's very good stuff. Highly recommended, the same as Sam. And, anytime you're thinking about email in the cloud, this is definitely one to consider.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, I look forward to really understanding Docker a lot more. I think there's a lot of potential to that technology. It's just one of those things that I have not had a chance to look into in any detail. So maybe you and I can discuss it in more detail, Sujit, over lunch sometimes.
Sure, sure. As a matter of fact, I'm anxiously awaiting the Windows version of Docker to come out, so that'll make it a little more interesting for us. But it's just amazing, Cale, that SendGrid is such an integral component of Azure, and it's what we're at episode 114, and it's taken us this long to get to it. I don't understand how we took so long to get to this fabulous.
It is crazy that invariably, you will hit this. I mean, if you do enough stuff up on Azure, eventually you have to send email. Like, you're going to hit this thing at some
exactly.
point with one of your apps. Yeah.
Well, Sam, appreciate your time so much and all your insight into Azure. It's very comforting to hear your experiences and very useful as well. Sam, if you have any links or tips, some of the tips that you mentioned, if you have any links that you want to share, we can add them to the show notes of the website so that
it will go along with
the podcast. Our listeners can avail of that quickly then.
Sure, right. Sure. I'll drop you an email by tomorrow.
That'll be great. Thanks so much.
Sure, sure.
All right. Thanks again, Sam. This was awesome, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for asking me. I appreciate it.
Sure.
It's been great.
Take care, then.
Bye. Okay, take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.